listeners, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. This year's Academy Awards certainly had its fair share of surprises. In last week's Salute to Hollywood, we spotlighted titles upon which many of the Oscar nominees were based. Inevitably, some nominees we believed were most worthy did not walk away with the Oscar. So it goes. But it got me thinking about literary awards. While we may have read several of this year's award winners, what about those contenders? Today, we'll preview books that made the shortlist of two of the most prestigious literary prizes, the Man Booker Prize and the National Book Award. I think you'll find these contenders to be worth a closer look. So let's have at it as we turn to page one of the book report. The Man Booker Prize was established in 1969. The prize, which had, until now, only been open to novelists holding a British, Irish, Commonwealth, or Zimbabwean passport, is now opened up to any author writing in English and published in the UK. This year's winner was Eleanor Catton for The Luminaries. You'll find a preview of that title on bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of December 14, 2013. We're going to start today's show with several books shortlisted for the 2013 Booker Prize. And what a selection! First, The Testament of Mary by Colm Tobin, performed by the incomparable Meryl Streep. In the ancient town of Ephesus, Mary lives alone, years after her son's crucifixion. She has no interest in collaborating with the authors of the gospel. They are her keepers, providing her with food and shelter and visiting her regularly. She does not agree that her son was the son of God, nor that he died for us all, nor that the group of misfits gathered around him were holy disciples. In this work, the woman we know as the docile, loving, silent, long-suffering, obedient, worshipful mother of Christ becomes a tragic heroine with the relentless eloquence of Electra or Antigone. The New York Times Book Review described this title by saying, "Streep's voice is familiar to generations of moviegoers, but its beauty as an instrument can be appreciated in this context as it often cannot be in films." Let's listen.
Of the two men who come, one was there with us until the end. There were moments then when he was soft, ready to hold me and comfort me, as he is ready now to scowl impatiently when the story I tell him does not stretch to whatever limits he has ordained. Yet I can see signs of that softness still. And there are times when the glow in his eyes returns before he sighs and goes back to his work, writing out the letters one by one that make words he knows I cannot read, which recount what happened on the hill and the days before and the days that followed. I have asked him to read the words aloud to me, but he will not. I know that he has written of things that neither he saw nor I saw. I know that he has also given shape to what I lived through and he witnessed, and that he has made sure that these words will matter, that they will be listened to. I remember too much. I'm like the air on a calm day as it holds itself still, letting nothing escape. As the world holds its breath, I keep memory in. So when I told him about the rabbits, I was not telling him something that I had half forgotten and merely remembered because of his insistent presence. The details of what I told him were with me all the years in the same way as my hands or my arms were with me. On that day, the day he wanted details of, the day he wanted me to go over and over for him, in the middle of everything that was confused, in the middle of all the terror and shrieking and the crying out, a man came close to me who had a cage with a huge, angry bird trapped in it, the bird all sharp-beaked, indignant gaze. The wings could not stretch to their full width, and this confinement seemed to make the bird frustrated and angry. It should have been flying, hunting, swooping on its prey. The man also carried a bag, which I gradually learned was almost half full of live rabbits, little bundles of fierce and terrorized energy. And during those hours on that hill, during the hours that went more slowly than any other hours, he plucked the rabbits one by one from the sack and edged them into the barely opened cage. The bird went for some part of their soft underbelly first, opening the rabbit up until its guts spilled out, and then, of course, its eyes. It is easy to talk about this now because it was a mild distraction from what was really going on. And it is easy to talk about it, too, because it made no sense. The bird did not seem to be hungry, although perhaps it suffered from a deep hunger that even the live flesh of writhing rabbits could not satisfy. The cage became half full of half-dead, wholly uneaten rabbits, exuding strange squealing sounds, twitching with old bursts of life. And the man's face was all bright with energy. There was a glow from him as he looked at the cage, and then at the scene around him, almost smiling with dark delight. The sack, not yet empty.
We've just heard The Testament of Mary by Colm Tobin. Harvest by Jim Craich was also shortlisted for the 2013 Booker Prize. A remote English village wakes on the morning after harvest, looking forward to enjoying a hard-earned day of rest and feasting. But two mysterious columns of smoke mar the sky, raising alarm and suspicion. The first smoke column comes from the edge of the village, sent as a signal by newcomers to announce their presence as per regional custom. The second smoke column comes from a blaze set in Master Kent's stables. Walter Thirsk, a relative outsider in the village, casts his eye on three local boys and blames their careless tomfoolery. The rest of the villagers, though, close ranks against the strangers rather than accuse one of their own. Two men and a woman are apprehended. Their heads are shaved to mark their criminality, and the men are thrown into the stocks for a week. Justice has been served. Or has it? Meanwhile, another newcomer has been spotted in the village, sporting the fine clothes and fashionable beard of a townsman. Mr. Quill observes them closely and takes careful notes about their land, apparently at Master Kent's behest. It is his presence more than any other that will threaten the village's entire way of life. John Keating performs this expertly crafted prose, detailing the unraveling of a bucolic life in the face of economic progress.
Little Lizzie Carr and her green sash are in Master Jordan's custody tonight, as is, or so the rumour has it for the moment. Mr. Quill and I have yet to see the living evidence. The Widow Goss, my Kitty Goss, together with Anne Rogers, her best friend. We need to organise ourselves, of course. This is the moment when our wildest hotheads should raise their sickles and their sticks. But John Carr thinks the hottest heads have already packed their bags and gone. Certainly, Brooker Higgs has not been seen since dusk. And the Derby twins were spotted heading off toward our top end and the setting sun, bundles roped across their backs, and walking faster than they've ever walked before. Their mother looks as grey and blank as pewter, and only shakes her head when questioned. Three of our sons are vagabonds, untethered strays, who clearly feel it safer to be anywhere but here. That has never happened to our sons before. Whose version of events should I believe? The loudest voices that I overhear are decided, as am I, reluctantly, that the shaven, black-haired woman is behind it all. A dozen different stories hold Mistress Beldam responsible for all the disarrangement of their cottages. And then for every odour that's not pleasing, for every jug of curdled milk, for every darkening of cloud. And she will take the blame, I know, for driving sheep into our fields. Everything's uncertain and unhinged because of her. She's brought a curse onto our land. She's blighted us. My neighbours say she'll not be satisfied until we're all dragged off to rot away with Willow Jack. When the threshing barn was inspected at midday, they told the new gentleman's serving men as much, and that the bloody velvet shawl claimed by Master Kent to be his wife's was not his wife's at all, but the property of this fierce, alluring woman. But no one listens to them any more, they now complain. No one's been hunting for the sorceress, despite their warnings. Those men are picking only on the innocent, on local women and a girl. What's certain, according to these flapping tongues, is that while I was on my knees this afternoon, making pauper's vellum from the calf, Lizzie Carr, still very much the gleaning queen in her green cloth and bored with sorting barley, slipped out of the threshing barn, hoping to renew the yellow blossoms she'd been wearing since her crowning. She was bound to be noticed by Edmund Jordan's men, and they were bound to challenge her. This girl, bedecked beyond her station in a valuable cloth and mustardy with flowers, like a fairy child, was far too young and tame to fit the description of the savage woman they'd only recently been informed about by the less wary of my neighbours, and whom the sidemen were now very keen to meet. But she was baffling, and her clothing was suspicious. The men supposed that all expensive cloth, Lizzie Carr's green sash, that woman's bloody velvet shawl, must provide some necessary clue in their pursuit of Willow Jack's killer. The meaning of those shawls and sashes, not to mention Master Jordan's too easy-going cousin's lies, would reveal itself in time, no doubt, and after thorough questioning, beginning with this mystifying child. As I imagine it, the men will have held Lizzie Carr by her irresistible plaits, like her uncles will have done 1,000 times before, like I have done myself. They would have been more playful than spiteful at first, and meant only to prevent her skipping off. Why was she in the lane at all, they'd want to know? Hadn't she been instructed quite clearly by Master Jordan that nobody must stray today beyond the barn? And, more to the point, how was it that a common little girl like her was sporting such a fine and pretty dressing on her head?
That was Harvest by Jim Craich. Today we are speaking with Noviolet Bulawayo, the author of We Need New Names, a book the New York Times called, quote, a deeply felt and fiercely written debut novel. Noviolet was born and raised in Zimbabwe. Her stories have won the 2011 Kane Prize for African Writing and shortlisted for other prestigious awards, including the 2013 Man Booker Prize. Noviolet earned her MFA at Cornell University, where she was a recipient of the Truman Capote Fellowship and most recently was a lecturer of English. She is now a Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford University. Welcome, Noviolet. It's a pleasure to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me, Elaine.
We Need New Names. Does the title reference back to the children who you meet on page one, whose names are Bastard, Cheapo, God Knows, and others?
It does reference to the children and the many interesting names that I have in the book. But it also speaks to the need for new identities as a country, new ways of seeing ourselves, new ways of imagining our destinies.
Introduce us to Darling.
Darling is a 10-year-old girl who is growing up in a shanty town after her family loses their home due to a government operation. And she is mostly found playing with her friends, Bastard Chipo, God knows, Tina and Spo, and trying to survive because they are growing up at a time when the country is falling apart due to failure of leadership. In the midst of all this, Darling is able to escape to the United States to live with an aunt in Kalamazoo, Michigan. But she gets there to realize that the American dream is not what it's cut out to be. And by the end of the novel, she's sort of struggling and failing to call this place home.
I've been very fortunate to have visited Zimbabwe 2 times, but I believe most Americans have not ever visited Zimbabwe or know a lot about your country's history. How have American audiences reacted to the book?
I've had a lot of good feedback from American readers and beyond American readers, from readers in general. And I think part of it is that literature or art allows people to cross borders and visit countries and places that they are not familiar with. And what ends up mattering is not the space itself, but the character and their story and their dream. So I think most people who have reached out to me at least seem to be connecting with Darling on that level. And I think that's all that matters.
This is a quote from the book. "I don't go to school anymore because all the teachers left to teach over in South Africa, Botswana, and Namibia, and where there's better money." Is this true? Is this still going on?
At the time I was writing, there was a mass movement of people from Zimbabwe to other countries in search of better pastures. And professionals and teachers included were among those. So what happened is that teachers left, and the education system that had been one of the best education systems in Africa sort of went downhill. It's not to say that kids were without teachers, but they were without qualified, the kind of qualified teachers that I grew up with, for instance. But that, of course, being a fiction book, it sort of puts it in your face. Now Zimbabwe is experiencing some stability. It's certainly a different country from the country that inspired the story. But still, it doesn't mean that things are perfect. I think we have a long way to go.
One of the narrator's friends, Chipo, is 11, and she's pregnant. We find that here very shocking. Was that a common occurrence?
That Chipo is 11 years old and pregnant is not a common occurrence at all. But that it's not common does not mean that it doesn't happen altogether. I am interested in things and issues that go on unaddressed or untold. And child abuse is one of them, you know, and I think it's something that goes beyond Zimbabwe's borders. I think even here in the U.S., you have cases of kids being abused in different ways. So that's just my way of drawing attention to a subject that I really, really care about. And of course, one would want that in a perfect world, we don't have 11-year-olds being victims, but I believe they are there.
One scene that really struck me was when the NGO or the philanthropic organization came to the town. There is certainly a lot of debate, plus and minus, about the effects of the NGO in Africa. What's your opinion?
Where the NGOs are concerned, it's a mixed bag, of course. When I'm thinking of Zimbabwe, especially during the lost decade, the time that we now know as the lost decade, when systems started unraveling, the NGOs kind of played an important role in bringing some stability in terms of providing goods that were not accessible. And you cannot dismiss that kind of aid. That said, I'm also interested on the other side of the coin, where the receiver is sort of reduced by their circumstance, reduced from a person to a nameless being, sort of. And when you look at the interactions in the novel, the children observe that even though the NGO are donating goods, they are also not interested in making contact with them as humans. And I feel like this is the time when we should reimagine the ways that the NGO and people on the ground, not just in Zimbabwe, sort of interact. And I'm all for the preservation of people's humanity and dignity and the kind of aid that moves people forward, not the kind of aid that sort of solves issues on a temporary matter and creates a cycle of dependency, just as we see in the shantytown where adults don't do anything and just wait for NGOs.
You referred to the last decade. For our listeners who aren't familiar with your country's history, when is that? When was that?
It was roughly around the early 2000s to 2009-2010. So that whole decade when, you know, failure of leadership led to a crisis that was unlike anything independent Zimbabwe had ever seen before.
In one scene in the book, an angry crowd of black Zimbabweans confronts a white man and woman at their home, and the man shouts, "I am an African. My father was born here. I was born here, just like you." How should he have been answered by the crowd?
That's a difficult question, and the question itself came from my interest and concern, because sometime during the Zimbabwean crisis, white farmers lost their land because it was believed that they didn't own the land. And of course, that's traceable to the fact that their ancestors came from outside. But I feel like an African is it's not a neat identity. It should not be grounded on race. I feel like as long as somebody is born in Africa, they are an African.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Towards the end of the book, there was a phone conversation with Darling and her friend back in Zimbabwe. And her friend says, "Why did you just leave? It is your country. You have to love it, to live in it, and not leave it. You have to fight for it, no matter what, to make it right. Is this your struggle?"
Absolutely. That's my struggle. And that's the kind of conversations. I was lucky to be writing We Need New Names at a time when social media was a big thing. And we took to Facebooks where we had conversations and debates. And there was an issue of who owned the Zimbabwean story, who had the right to question and point fingers. And of course, some of us who were outside felt like people on the ground should be doing something. And of course, there was the Arab Spring somewhere in the background. And we're like, look what's happening in other countries. And people on the ground were like, look, you are not here. You know, you can't tell us we are not doing anything when you are speaking from the safety of the many countries that you have fled to. And for me, as a young person, there is that guilt that I am out in the U.S. Living a different life when people on the ground are sort of struggling and without the resources that I'm surrounded with. So, yeah.
Would you consider moving back full time to Zimbabwe?
I have started going back and forth, and at least at this stage in my career, I see myself splitting my time between home and the U.S. And home not necessarily being Zimbabwe. I've spent time in South Africa too, and Tanzania, and I connect intimately to those spaces. But I'm at a point where I'm just restless. I don't feel like being in one place. Yeah.
What was it like for you to learn that you were shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, the first person from Zimbabwe ever to have that honor?
It was very, very humbling because, you know, We Need New Names is only my first book. And when I was writing, I guess when you are creating and creating your first product, you're not necessarily thinking of its life afterwards. So that came when I was not expecting it. But as a young writer, I'm very much encouraged to keep going. Yeah.
Listeners, I want to say that this is an incredible book that's getting rave reviews all over. We Need New Names. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much, Elaine.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of We Need New Names, performed by Robin Miles.
She just takes off and we run after her. When we get right to the middle of Budapest, we stop. This place is not like paradise. It's like being in a different country altogether. A nice country where people who are not like us live. But then you don't see anything to show there are real people living here. Even the air itself is empty. No delicious food cooking, no odors, no sounds, just nothing. Budapest is big, big houses with satellite dishes on the roofs and neat graveled yards or trimmed lawns, and the tall fences and the dura walls and the flowers and the big trees heavy with fruit that's waiting for us, since nobody around here seems to know what to do with it. It's the fruit that gives us courage. Otherwise, we wouldn't dare be here. I keep expecting the clean streets to spit and tell us to go back where we came from. At first, we used to steal from Stina's uncle, who now lives in Britain. But that was not stealing. Because it was Stina's uncle's tree and not a stranger's. There's a difference. But then we finished all the guavas in that tree, so we have moved to the other houses as well. We have stolen from so many houses, I cannot even count. It was Bestad who decided that we pick a street and stay on it until we have gone through all the houses. Then we go to the next street. This is so we don't confuse where we have been with where we are going. It's like a pattern. And Bestad says, this way we can be better thieves. Today, we are starting a new street, and so we are carefully scouting around. We are passing Chimurenga Street, where we've already harvested every guava tree, maybe like 2-3 weeks ago, when we see white curtains part and a face peer from a window of the cream home with the marble statue of the urinating naked boy with wings. We are standing and staring, looking to see what the face will do, when the window opens and a small funny voice shouts for us to stop. We remain standing, not because the voice told us to stop, but because none of us has started to run, and also because the voice doesn't sound dangerous. Music pours out of the window onto the street. It's not kwaito, it's not dance hall, it's not house, it's not anything we know.
We've just heard We Need New Names by Noviolet Bulawayo. In today's last look at Booker Prize contenders, we'll preview Ruth Ozeki's A Tale for the Time Being. In Tokyo, 16-year-old Nao has decided there's only one escape from her aching loneliness and her classmates' bullying. Before she ends it all, Nao first plans to document the life of her great-grandmother, a Buddhist nun who's lived more than a century. The diary is Nao's only solace and will touch lives in ways she can scarcely imagine. Across the Pacific, we meet Ruth, a novelist living on a remote island who discovers a collection of artifacts washed ashore in a Hello Kitty lunchbox, possibly debris from the devastating 2011 tsunami. As the mystery of its contents unfolds, Ruth is pulled into the past, into Nao's drama and her unknown fate, and forward into her own future. The author narrates.
A tiny sparkle caught Ruth's eye. A small glint of refracted sunlight angling out from beneath a massive tangle of drying bull kelp, which the sea had heaved up onto the sand at full tide. She mistook it for the sheen of a dying jellyfish and almost walked right by it. The beaches were overrun with jellyfish these days, the monstrous red stinging kind that looked like wounds along the shoreline. But something made her stop. She leaned over and nudged the heap of kelp with the toe of her sneaker, then poked it with a stick. Untangling the whip-like fronds, she dislodged enough to see that what glistened underneath was not a dying sea jelly, but something plastic. A bag. Not surprising. The ocean was full of plastic. She dug a bit more until she could lift the bag up by its corner. It was heavier than she expected, a scarred plastic freezer bag encrusted with barnacles that spread across its surface like a rash. It must have been in the ocean for a long time, she thought. Inside the bag, she could see a hint of something red. Someone's garbage, no doubt, tossed overboard or left behind after a picnic or a rave. The sea was always heaving things up and hurling them back. Fishing lines, floats, beer cans, plastic toys, tampons, Nike sneakers. A few years earlier, it was severed feet. People were finding them up and down Vancouver Island, washed up on the sand. One had been found on this very beach. No one could explain what had happened to the rest of the bodies. Ruth didn't want to think about what might be rotting inside the bag. She flung it farther up the beach. She would finish her walk and then pick it up on the way back, take it home, and throw it out. 2. "What's this?" her husband called from the mudroom. Ruth was cooking dinner, chopping carrots, and concentrating. "This," Oliver repeated when she didn't answer. She looked up. He was standing in the doorway of the kitchen, dangling the large, scarred freezer bag in his fingers. She'd left it out on the porch, intending to deposit it in the trash, but she'd gotten distracted. "Oh, leave it," she said. "It's garbage, something I picked up on the beach. Please don't bring it in the house." Why did she have to explain? "But there's something in it," he said. "Don't you want to know what's inside?" "No," she said. "Dinner's almost ready." He brought it in anyway and laid it on the kitchen table, scattering sand. He couldn't help it. It was his nature to need to know, to take things apart and sometimes put them back together. Their freezer was filled with plastic shrouds containing the tiny carcasses of birds, shrews, and other small animals that their cat had brought in, waiting to be dissected and stuffed. "It's not just one bag," he reported, carefully unzipping the first and laying it aside. "It's bags within bags." The cat, attracted by all the activity, jumped up onto the table to help. He wasn't allowed on the table. The cat had a name, Schrodinger, but they never used it. Oliver called him the pest, which sometimes morphed into pesto. He was always doing bad things, disemboweling squirrels in the middle of the kitchen, leaving small, shiny organs, kidneys and intestines, right outside their bedroom door, where Ruth would step on them with her bare feet on her way to the bathroom at night. They were a team, Oliver and the cat. When Oliver went upstairs, the cat went upstairs. When Oliver came downstairs to eat, the cat came downstairs to eat. When Oliver went outside to pee, the cat went outside to pee. Now, Ruth watched the two of them as they examined the contents of the plastic bags. She winced, anticipating the stench of someone's rotting picnic, or worse, that would ruin the fragrance of their meal. Lentil soup. They were having lentil soup and salad for dinner, and she'd just put in the rosemary. "Do you think you could dissect your garbage out on the porch?" "You picked it up," he said. "And anyway, I don't think it's garbage. It's too neatly wrapped." He continued his forensic unpeeling. Ruth sniffed, but all she could smell was sand and salt and sea. Suddenly he started laughing. "Look, pesto," he said. "It's for you. It's a Hello Kitty lunchbox." "Please," Ruth said, feeling desperate now. "And there's something inside. I'm serious. I don't want you to open it in here. Just take it out." But it was too late.
We've just heard A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki. And now on to the National Book Award, which was won this year by James McBride for The Good Lord Bird. You'll find that title on bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of November 23rd, 2013. Today on The Book Report, we're going to preview two contenders for this prestigious award. Pacific is a triumphant return to the characters that launched Tom Drury's career two decades ago in The End of Vandalism. In this title, 14-year-old Micah Darling travels to L.A. to reunite with the mother who deserted him 7 years ago. He finds himself out of his league in a land of magical freedom. He does drugs, falls in love with an enchanting but troubled girl, and gets thrown out of school. Back in the Midwest, an ethereal young woman comes to Stone City on a mission that will unsettle the lives of everyone she meets, including Micah's half-sister Lyris, who still fights fears of abandonment after a childhood in foster care. An investigation into the stranger's identity uncovers a darkly disturbed life as parallel narratives of the comic and tragic, the mysterious and the everyday unfold in both the country and the city. Lloyd James narrates.
Tiny and Micah sat on the back porch of the house where they lived outside the town of Boris, watching the sun go down behind the train tracks and the trees. "Say you're carrying something," said Tiny. "Yeah, like what?" 14 years old, Micah wore a forest green stocking hat, his hair curved like feathers around his calm brown eyes.
"Something of value," said Tiny. "This ashtray here. Say this ashtray is of value."
The ashtray was made of green glass with yellowed seashells glued to the rim. Likely it came from Yellowstone or some other tourist place originally.
It might have been of value.
Micah picked it up and walked to the end of the porch and back.
"Good," said Tiny. "Something of value you carry in front of you and never at your side."
"I just didn't want the ashes to fall out."
"Now say you get in a fight."
"Yeah, I'm not doing that."
"What you do is you put your head down and ram them in the solar plexus. It's unexpected."
"I wouldn't expect it."
"Well, no one does," said Tiny. "Sometimes they faint. They almost always fall over."
"Got it.
And never, never get a credit card."
"How would I pay it back?"
"You wouldn't. That's the idea."
It was a cool night in May. The red sky shaded the grass and the shed and the house.
"Do you still want to go?" said Tiny. "You can change your mind any time."
"Dad, I've never been in an airplane."
"We could get Paul Francis to take you up."
"I mean a real airplane."
Tiny nodded. "I just said that to be saying something."
A band-tailed Cooper's hawk came from the west and landed on a hardwood branch with new leaves.
"There's your hawk," said Tiny. "Come to say goodbye."
Dan Norman walked out of his house carrying the pieces of a broken table. He and Louise still lived on the old Clark farm on the hill. The table had fallen apart in the living room. It was not bearing unusual weight, and neither Dan nor Louise was nearby when it fell. Just the table's time, apparently. A car pulled slowly into the driveway, and a woman got out and stood in the yellow circle of the yard light. She had long blonde hair, wore a pleated red dress and white gloves.
That was Pacific by Tom Drury. Fools is a dazzling collection of interconnected stories by the National Book Award finalist Joan Silber. When is it wise to be a fool for something? What makes people want to be better than they are? From New York to India to Paris, from the Catholic worker movement to Occupy Wall Street, the characters in Silber's story cycle tackle this question head on. Vera, the shy anarchist daughter of missionary parents, leaves her family for love and activism in New York. A generation later, her own doubting daughter insists on the truth of being of two minds, even in marriage. The adulterous son of a Florida hotel owner steals money from his family and departs for Paris, where he takes up with a young woman and finds himself outsmarted in turn. Fools, performed by the author, ponders the circle of winners and losers, dupers and duped, and the price we pay for our beliefs.
A lot of people thought anarchists were fools. I finished high school in 1924, and even during my girlhood, when the fiercest wing of anarchists still believed in propaganda by deed and threw bombs and shot at world leaders, people thought they did it out of a bloody kind of sappiness, a laughable naivete. All this laughing, I came to think, ignored the number of things a person could be a fool for in this life. A fool for love, a fool for Christ, a fool for admiration. I had friends who were all of these, as it turned out. But I took my own route. I wasn't born into anarchism. I read myself into it. Someone handed me a pamphlet in the street, and that was the beginning. And my cousin Joe was an influence. Joe was a third cousin, hardly related at all. But in our teen years, we were both enlisted in my mother's brief attempt to distribute used clothes to the poor in our church. Musty woolen topcoats, faded school pinafores, piles and piles of men's hats. The problem was, my mother was afraid of the people who showed up for the clothes. We stood behind a table in the dank church basement while she pled for an orderly line and whispered at me not to touch the children. On the other side, Joe was muttering to me about why we had these extra goods and they didn't. I was born in India, in the city of Madras, in the state of Tamil Nadu. When my father was a missionary for the Congregationalist Church, we went home to Philadelphia when I was 6, but I had memories. My father left the mission in a state of great disillusion, embittered by ecclesiastical infighting in a country so filled with suffering. In America, I was mocked for the way my speech sounded Indian and was hounded in school by a group of bullying girls. In my adult life, when my friends heard I came from a missionary family, they teased me about how I naturally came from a long line of zealots, didn't I? Which was how I liked to view it. Actually, the zealotry had drained by the time I was growing up. My father was just another bald, tired minister who mumbled through the services and didn't really want to look anyone in the eye. My mother was more ardent, more desperate. I hated the unbearable ladies' aid meetings in our living room and the tedious Sunday school with my poor mother teaching improbable platitudes. In high school, I was infamous for cynical jokes about the Virgin Mary. Only Joe was worse in the school auditorium. He passed me notes parodying the psalm read in assembly. He that hath clean hands and a pure heart and always washes with Baraxo. When I was reading the books Joe lent me, I felt a kind of joyous relief once I got past the hard parts. What I loved in anarchism from the first was the obvious truth in it. People had gotten it all wrong to expect justice from any state. Power never protected the weak. It only protected itself. Tyranny was built into the system. The clarity of this argument was pretty stunning, I thought, and so was its insistence that this didn't have to continue, despite its long human history.
That was Fools by Joan Silber. In his brilliant, haunting novel, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, National Book Award nominee Anthony Mara transports us to a snow-covered village in Chechnya, where 8-year-old Hava watches from the woods as Russian soldiers abduct her father, accusing him of aiding Chechen rebels. Across the road, their lifelong neighbor and family friend, Ahmed, has also been watching, fearing the worst when soldiers set fire to Hava's house. But when he finds her hiding in the forest with a strange blue suitcase, he makes a decision that will forever change their lives. He will seek refuge at the abandoned hospital where the sole remaining doctor, Sonia Rabina, treats the wounded. For the talented, tough-minded Sonia, the arrival of Ahmed and Hava is an unwelcome surprise. Weary and overburdened, she has no desire to take on additional responsibility and risk. Harboring these refugees could easily jeopardize the return of her missing sister. But over the course of 5 extraordinary days, Sonia's world will shift on its axis and reveal the intricate pattern of connections that weave together the past. Colette Whitaker narrates.
On the morning after the feds burned down her house and took her father, Hava woke from dreams of sea anemones. While the girl dressed, Ahmed, who hadn't slept at all, paced outside the bedroom door, watching the sky brighten on the other side of the window glass. The rising sun had never before made him feel late. When she emerged from the bedroom, looking older than her 8 years, he took her suitcase and she followed him out the front door. He had led the girl to the middle of the street before he raised his eyes to what had been her house.
Hava, we should go,
he said, but neither moved. The snow softened around their boots as they stared across the street to the wide patch of flattened ash. A few orange embers hissed in pools of gray snow, but all else was char. Not 7 years earlier, Ahmed had helped Oka build an addition, so the girl would have a room of her own. He had drawn the blueprints and chopped the hardwood and cut it into boards and turned them into a room. And when Duka had promised to help him build an addition to his own house, should he ever have a child, Ahmed had thanked his friend and walked home, the knot in his throat unraveling into a sob when the door closed behind him. Carrying that lumber the 40 meters from the forest had left his knuckles blistered, his underarms sobbing, but now a few hours of flames had lifted what had taken him months to design, weeks to carry, days to build. all but the nails and rivets, all but the hinges and bolts, all into the sky. And too were carried the small treasures that had made Dukkha's house his own. There was the hand-carved chess set on a round side table. When moved, the squat white king wobbled from side to side, like a man just sober enough to stand. And Dukkha had named his majesty Boris Yeltsin. There was the porcelain vase adorned with Persian arabesques, and beside that a cassette deck radio with an antenna long enough to scrape the ceiling when propped up on a telephone book, yet too short to reach anything but static. There was the 85-year-old Quran, the purple cover writhing with calligraphy, that Dukkha's grandfather had purchased in Mecca. There were these things, and the flames ate these things. And since fire doesn't distinguish between the word of God and the word of the Soviet Communications Registry Bureau, both Quran and telephone directory returned to his mouth in the same inhalation of smoke. The girl's fingers braceleted his wrist. He wanted to throw her over his shoulder and sprint northward until the forest swallowed the village. But standing before the blackened timbers, he couldn't summon the strength to bring a consoling word to his lips, to hold the girl's hand in his own, to move his feet in the direction he wanted them to go. "That's my house." Her voice broke their silence, and he heard it as he would the only sound in an empty corridor.
"Don't think of it like that," he said.
"Like what?"
"Like it's still yours."
He wound her bright orange scarf around her neck and frowned at the sooty fingerprint on her cheek. He had been awake in bed the previous night when the feds came. First the murmur of a diesel engine, a low rumble he'd come to fear more than gunfire, then Russian voices. He had gone to the living room and pulled back the blackout curtain as far as he dared. Through the triangle of glass, headlights parted the night. Four soldiers, stocky, well-fed, emerged from the truck. One drank from a vodka bottle and cursed the snow each time he stumbled.
We've just heard A Constellation of Vital Phenomena by Anthony Mara. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed these worthy runners-up and will award them honors by giving them a spot on your reading list. For more ideas on what to read next, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you back here in a week for the next edition of The Book Reports.